Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, if NYU can put students through medical school tuition free, why can't other med schools follow their lead? NYU announced last month that they will cover the tuition for all would-be doctors, regardless of income or need. They raised a $450 million endowment to do it. The decision was praised and critiqued, and we're going to talk about why. But I'd like to hear from you on this, too. If you are in medical school or practicing as a physician, did you graduate with a big chunk of debt? Did that debt influence your decision about where and how you would practice medicine? And for the rest of us who didn't go to med school, what do we all think of this idea? So I want to hear from you if you are practicing medicine in medical school, what you think about the idea of free tuition, but also whether it limited or influenced where you decided to practice medicine and how you practiced medicine. And for the rest of us, I'd be interested in your thoughts, your insights on this. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. It's KerriMPR. Our guest this hour, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, is a physician, editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, and author of An American Sickness, and she joins us today from Washington. Dr. Rosenthal, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Deborah Powell is with me in the studio. She's a physician, dean emerita at the University of Minnesota Medical School, and still a professor at the U of M. And Dr. Powell, welcome. Really good to have you in the studio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Dr. Rosenthal, you went to Harvard Medical School. That runs about $61,000 a year on tuition. Do you remember what it was when you were in med school?
Oh, it was much, much less. That was in the late 80s, and it was probably around $10,000 a year. So there's been
huge inflation
of tuition.
Yeah. Dr. Powell, you graduated from Tufts University Medical School, right?
I did, yes.
That also runs around $60,000 or $61,000 a year. Do you remember how much it was when you went to medical school?
I do. It was $1,200.
What?
Yes.
$1,200?
Yes, and I got a scholarship.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, just because these numbers kind of blow my mind. Why has medical school gotten so much more expensive? Dr. Powell, do you know?
Oh, I think it's a compilation of many, many, many things. And no one thing is responsible for it. You know, we've seen rising tuitions at the undergraduate level. Medical school has followed. I think that we've seen an explosion of new medical schools, and they've been very tuition dependent, so they have raised tuitions also. But the trend has been upward staggeringly in the last few years.
I think, Dr. Rosenthal, I saw a number here that said that tuition, medical school tuition, had gone up 75% or something in the last 25 years. What accounts for that?
Well, I think you have to ask the medical schools what accounts for that. I mean, I remember when I was a med student at Harvard, there was endless discussion about what tuition should support. You know, do we think med school students should be paying for lab space for the medical school in general? Should it pay for heating in dorms? You know, there's all of these issues. And medical schools have a lot of different sources of income. So, you know, both at the undergraduate level and at the graduate level, both in, as was noted, law school, med school, business school, the tuitions are really out of control. And I think that's what NYU was trying to address. But of course, no one is trying to address that by actually reducing tuition or not increasing it. So
noted. All right. I want to take a call here from a retired physician, to Greg in St. Paul. Greg, thanks for the call. How much was medical school when you went to school?
$5,000.
Wow. So what's your thought about what NYU is doing here?
Well, I support it. Throughout my career, medical school has been available more and more just to upper middle class people or people with some kind of connection, often doctors in the family or scientists. And it's really not available, practically speaking, to huge swaths of our population which distorts the profession, I think hampers overall what our profession could provide. It's obscenely high. Just think of the problem with college tuition and multiply it. And it clearly influences how many people go into primary care, which is not nearly enough, so that we're really not serving people adequately. We don't have adequate access for primary care. So I support what they're doing, and I think this should be done for every medical school across the country.
All right. Greg, thank you. Dr. Rosenthal, you support what NYU is doing to a limit, right?
Yeah.
You have some critiques about this. First, tell me what you think, whether you think Greg is right, that it will bring people to medical school who normally wouldn't be able to go.
Well, I think there's some truth in that. You know, when you look at people who graduate from medical school and become doctors, the reality is almost all of them pay off their loans quite easily. I did, certainly, even though the tuition was much lower then. But statistically, they will pay off those loans just fine. That being said, if you're 26 and you get out of medical school, I have a daughter who's 26, and you have $200,000 in debt, that feels scary and overwhelming. So I think it does influence people's choices in, do I want to be a pediatrician where I won't get paid so much, or do I want to be an interventional radiologist where I know I'll pay off my loans really quickly? So the perception really matters here. But I would point out it's not only in medical school, it's in business school, it's in law school. If we want people to go into public interest law, or we want people to go into NGOs with their business learning, we need to have a way to support that choice without having these huge loans hanging over your head. So, yes, I think it does affect career choice. It affects who goes into medical school, who goes to business school, who goes to law school. And I think we need to do something about that. I think the NYU approach, though, is flawed.
And we'll talk about why. Dr. Powell, though, I take Dr. Rosenthal at her word here that, yes, that sounds like a lot of money hanging over your head when you graduate, but you're going to make a lot of money, mostly, you know,
yes.
And you're going to have those loans paid off pretty quickly. I mean, what's NYU really addressing here, if that's true?
I think they're really trying to address the issue of the small number of students who will never consider a career in medicine. And this is a huge issue, and the caller referred to that.
But I mean, you said it's a small number of students who
will. Well, there could be a larger number of students. I mean, right now, over 60% of our students come from people whose families are in the top quintile of family income in this country. That hasn't changed for a long time. And we're really disenfranchising a large number of very bright students for whom debt is something they're not familiar with. So if you take students whose parents have not owned a home, who have never seen someone borrow to increase equity in something, they don't really equate the debt with the future salary. They just see the debt as debt. I'm not sure that full tuition for everyone is the answer, but I do think that we might broaden the base if the tuition wasn't quite so high.
Therese says, I've written a few times about my struggle as a single mom. I'm taking prerequisites and thinking about med school. Science is in my blood. Thanks for the important conversation. To Stacy in Plymouth. Hi, Stacy. How does the cost of medical school affect the decisions that you've made?
I'm really happy you guys are having this discussion. I was accepted to medical school right out of college during the 90s, and frankly, the cost of med school and my reluctance to take on that much debt was one of the primary reasons that I chose a different career.
And when you factored in, well, if I get through medical school and I become a doctor, I'm going to be making a lot of money and I can chip away at that debt pretty quickly, where did that come out?
I would have to agree with some of the previous comments that at that stage in my life, all I could see was the amount of that debt, and it wasn't clear to me that, you know, I was going to get to that place where I was going to be making enough money to offset that. It was just that huge hurdle of that initial amount that kind of put me off.
Good to have the call. Dr. Rosenthal, a minute ago you said what really happens here is that a number of students decide that they are not going to go into family practice or other specialties that don't compensate them that well. How do we know how medical school students are making these decisions?
Well, in fact, you know, this is somewhat theoretical because a number of surveys have showed that medical students, that cost and the salary and earning potential and debt is not a major factor as medical students decide, at least that they confess to, right? Or at least that they acknowledge. So it may be a lot of it is subliminal. A lot more of it has to do with gender, with ethnicity, where you grew up, what your intention was going in. So it's a really, really complicated decision, obviously. But I think the goal that we should all aspire to is to take away those financial hurdles, both to going into medical school and deciding that, hey, my passion, my inclination is to go into a non-remunerative practice in an inner city or in a rural area, and that's where my passion is, so I'm not going to let... And that's what we need. I mean, that's the point, too. Society needs this, so we should be enabling it with these financial incentives and plans.
Call here from Deborah in St. Paul. Hi, Deborah. What's your take on this?
Well, there's a shortage of doctors and nurses. The nursing shortage is just as bad as the doctor shortage, and we're the only so-called developed country in the world that doesn't provide paid education for all students. I mean, who's going to take care of us when we're old? Who's going to take care of our children?
I hear your argument here. Dr. Powell, if you're going to do this for medical school students, why not do it for nursing students? We're going to need them too.
Yeah, well, there's a shortage of a lot of health professional students, and it's particularly bad in certain areas. So not only is there probably, I'm not convinced, an overall shortage, but there's certainly a geographic maldistribution. And the tuition is high for all health professional students. Right. Vet students have the highest tuition in the country, and we're not talking about veterinary medicine. So I think we can't just look at physicians. We do need to look more broadly, but we're just taking one segment right now.
So, Dr. Rosenthal, you wrote in your piece in the New York Times, instead of making medical school free for everyone, NYU and all medical schools should waive tuition only for those students who commit to work where they are needed most. Describe how this would work.
Well, I think the thing that struck me about NYU's offer to make medical school free for all students is that NYU Law School actually has had a fascinating program that's been very successful for 50 years. And basically what that does is it reserves 20 slots in each law school class for students who promise to go into public interest law or public service. Those students pay no tuition. And the students who are more inclined to corporate law or working for a bank, they pay full tuition and will pay their loans back. So I think that is a much more smarter model than just saying, you know, okay, it's free for everyone, because you know what? If you decide you want to be a dermatologist in suburban New Jersey, where we have too many dermatologists already, fine, go do it, open, you know, put out your shingle, but pay your loans back because you're going to make plenty of money. So I would like that incentive used much more strategically to develop the medical workforce that we need. And what's ironic to me is that NYU's law school has done that for over 50 years.
So when I read that, I thought, well, who's going to decide what the needed most standard is, as in, what if you wanted to be a cardiologist, which is a pretty highly compensated specialty in the medical field, but you were interested in practicing in, let's say, rural Nevada, where there are not, where there are more cardiologists needed? So then you meet the standard of needed most?
Yeah. Well, I mean, those are the logistics which can be worked out. You can say in an underserved area, whether it's if it's a specialist in an underserved area or primary care anywhere. I mean, those things can be worked out. NYU's law school, you know, obviously they have to work out what counts as public service for those 20 students. And so, you know, I think you ask the student to you define what you think of as public service broadly, and let the students choose. And what they say to their students, which I find fascinating, because of course, you know, some students will change their mind. They'll say, "Wow, you know, I'm really interested in primary care, but oh my gosh, I love heart surgery. So now I decide I want to be a heart surgeon and I want to live in New York City." Okay, fair enough. What NYU says to its law students who go into this public service program is if you change your mind at any point after you graduate, it's your moral obligation to pay us back.
Hmm.
So they don't even have a kind of legal cudgel hanging over students' head. They trust. There's a trust. You know, you gave me a great education. I'm making a lot of money now, so I'm going to pay you back. So I think there are ways to work out the logistics that are certainly much better than this kind of broad brushstroke approach that they're taking now. I think it's a great first step, but let's refine it, and I hope other medical schools refine it to get more what we need, because the truth is, and I think some medical students from Mount Sinai wrote an op-ed about this over the weekend, that most medical schools will not be able to raise enough money to give free tuition.
I want to talk about that in a minute. Dr. Powell, do you agree that the needed most is really a better way, refining way, as Dr. Rosenthal says, to approach this? Or is NYU kind of going, we're just going to say we need more doctors and we know that we're going to get halfway down the road on this, and so we're going to make it free to everybody? Is that the better approach? What do you think?
I think the needed most is certainly right, and I think that the needed most is dependent on the area of the country and whether it's rural, inner city, urban, whatever.
So geography really matters here.
Geography really matters.
Okay.
A number of states have loan forgiveness programs for people who practice in underserved areas of their states and who also practice in underrepresented specialties. And I think that's also a viable alternative. Of course, there aren't enough of those, but still, it's getting at that issue.
Dr. Deborah Powell is with us. She's a physician, dean emerita at the University of Minnesota Medical School and a professor there. And Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal is a physician, editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and author of An American Sickness. We asked them both to come in to talk about this decision that NYU announced last week, that they will, or last month, I should say, that they will provide free tuition to anybody that gets into the NYU Medical School. They think that this will broaden the base of people who can train and become doctors. They received, I think, maybe unexpected to them, some criticism for that. And there's been and it started a really good conversation about what we do about the fact that maybe the medical field is closed off to people and there is need for physicians in certain areas, and how do you contrast that with the debt that people graduate from medical school with? So I'd love to hear from you this morning. If you're in medical school, you've considered it, you're practicing, did you graduate with a big chunk of debt? How did that influence your decision about where and how you would practice medicine? And then for the rest of us, I'd just love to hear your insight on the idea. 651-227-6000 on Twitter at @CarrieMPR, where a listener here says, Heather, I have a high school senior looking at med school for cardiology, will absolutely be looking into NYU now. Might lose her from the University of Minnesota there, Deborah, but I can see this would be a draw for people who are looking into med school. To Antoinette in St. Paul. Hey, Antoinette, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My son graduated from the University of Minnesota Medical School 4 years ago, and he graduated with a debt of $250,000, and that doesn't even upset me, but what upsets me is the federal legislation that loan is at 6% interest, and it constantly accrues, and he's in his fourth year of a five-year residency program and is trying to, you know, make payments, basic interest payments that he can at this point, but he's not going to be out practicing and earning money for probably three more years.
So you're saying he's paying interest on the loans and he's really not making a doctor's salary. Do you know what specialty he's going into, Antoinette?
Oh yes, he's going into orthopedic surgery, and so that's, like I say, a 5-year residency program versus 3 years for some, like, family physician positions.
Dr. Powell, he's going to make good money.
Yes, he will.
When he gets to it, right?
Yes, he will. But it's still very hard for residents because they are facing this debt, only paying off the interest, earning it's certainly much lower than a physician's salary for the years of their residency and probably their fellowship also if they're going into orthopedics. So they are facing something, and I think they have to have a very good handle on how they're going to structure their payments after residency.
This is the other thing I was going to ask you, Deborah, if you think as students are considering medical school, that number, the borrowing, seems realistic enough that they are making informed decisions about taking on that kind of debt.
I think some are. I think some aren't. My grandson is a second-year medical student now in Michigan at Wayne State, and I think there are lots of resources for young people that the pre-med advisors are aware of. The Association of American Medical Colleges has a wonderful program for debt management and really spells it out as sort of step-by-step how you manage this. Nevertheless, I think students borrow at their maximum.
Wow.
And that's a problem.
Oh my gosh.
Because we're only talking about tuition, but there's boards,
right,
and room, and then there's textbooks and computers, and many of them have to have transportation because they can't get to some of their rotations without that. And then there's payments for their licensing exams and for applying for residency, because many people look at least 15 residencies, and in the very competitive specialties, they look at many more, and they have to travel there for interviews. So the costs just add up and add up, and we don't think about those things.
Elizabeth, do you think that more, and I think college students do this, as you guys have pointed out, the business schools and some of the other special schools, that debt just doesn't seem real till you're accruing it and then have to pay it back.
Yeah, I think that's true for some students. For others, it's a deterrent. So I think we have to worry about both ends of the spectrum, people who jump in not thinking about the debt, and then perhaps because they were unrealistic, can't pay it back. We see a lot of this in law school, right. Much less in medical school. Doctors, when they graduate from medical school, will be employed at this point in time. But you also worry about the as we've spoken about, the people at the other end who don't even try because the debt scares them.
Nicole says on Twitter, I went into nursing instead of med school because it was more practical financially. I love nursing, but I still dream of a day when med school would be financially feasible. If cost weren't an issue, I'd enroll in a heartbeat. Now, she sounds like somebody you'd really want to be able to attain, right, that dream of going to med school. Jeremy says, my wife has decided to go through a PA program and practice rurally. Not sure PAs get enough credit or consideration in the primary care discussion. Elizabeth, what would you say to that, where the PAs fit in?
That's true. I mean, we certainly underutilize some of the paraprofessionals in medicine. We undervalue PAs, pharmacists, nurses. I think, as we talked about before, it's not clear that that is the final answer for us, though, because we need to redistribute physicians into those rural areas and into inner cities, as well as PAs. I think it's too easy to say, oh, we don't really need a doctor there. We can just put a bunch of physician assistants or nurse practitioners who are incredibly valuable, but they perform different roles in the system, mm-hmm. and they should perform different roles. And I think we have to address all of the above. It's not, a kind of one-size-fits-all answer.
Call here from Lucy in Minneapolis. Hi, Lucy. Appreciate you waiting.
Hi. How are you today?
Doing
Thank
well.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. You're a practicing cardiologist. Is that right?
I am. I practice in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. I'm about 5 years out in my practice. Mm-hmm. And I have a day off. It was, of course, listening to NPR.
Thank
my
you. Thanks.
So the reason I called in is because I think people underestimate the financial burden for physicians right now, and Unfortunately, it has drastically pushed people out of the primary care specialties. By 2025, they suspect will be about 20,000 primary care doctors short.
Wow.
It's absolutely staggering. That makes me very concerned, only because one day I will need primary care, and they're kind of the foothold of medicine, and there won't be enough doctors to take care of us all, which should terrify everyone. It really is a big emergency. So I called in just to express why I chose cardiology, not to mention I just adore it.
Yeah, good.
But when I finished medical school, granted, I did go to a private med school, but I was $260,000 in debt. And when I decided, I chose internal medicine and eventually landed in cardiology because I love it and because I was so terrified of my debt payback to go anywhere near primary care. The total of my debt had inflated to $360,000 by the time I finished cardiology.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty substantial. So when I finished, I was making $2,300 a month payments just for my school loan payback alone. The other thing I was telling your staff who answered is that by the time I finished cardiology fellowship, and granted, I did take 5 board exams just throughout the specialties, so it is a little heavy-handed on board exams, but I spent about $10,000 just in board exams alone. And each one of those board exams is about $1,000 in study material. So that was $20,000, and I was poor of credit card debt by the time I finished.
Oh, my gosh, Lucy. Wow.
It's pretty substantial. So I just wanted to express that I think it's so awesome that people are considering free schooling for physicians, but I really think it needs to be directed towards those who give less service or the underserved area treatment, like primary care doctors, rural doctors, and they should really have the first priority. I think the pushback and frustration will come from doctors like me, seeing other cardiologists coming out scot-free from educational debt, when what we really need is primary care doctors and incentivization for that going forward.
I'm really glad you called. That introduces actually a dimension of this I hadn't thought about. Deborah, yes, other cardiologists who might not have to bear that burden and doesn't solve the issue of more primary. Is there a danger of that?
I think there probably is, because I think that most physicians understand the underserved specialties and the underserved areas. I mean, primary care psychiatry is another one. With our aging population, with autism, with all of the things that we would like to have adult and child psychiatrists for. So I think most physicians are fully aware of the needed specialties, the wage disparities. While they can't do anything themselves, I think they would be in favor of trying to promote those specialties and perhaps not so much the highly paid lucrative specialties, which can pay off debt pretty soon.
Conversation here, if you've just gotten in on it, with Dr. Deborah Powell from the U of M, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal from Kaiser Health News, about NYU's decision to make medical school free, some of the implications of that, some of the reasons they came to that decision, and then some of the critiques that, or questions, or the good debate that has followed that decision. We'll get a look at the latest news when we come back. We're going to talk a little bit about the endowment, what NYU had to do to make this available, and why it would be tough for a number of medical schools to do it. Other ways to maybe move this along, and an op-ed that I read by a resident who said, medical school's too long. We make it shorter. We'll make it cheaper. We'll get people out there into the field quicker. So think about that on the other side of news and call in 651-227-6000 on Twitter at Carrie MBR. To Stephen John now with the latest. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning, Carrie. Officials along North Carolina's coast are issuing a mandatory evacuation order for all visitors and residents on Hatteras Island as Hurricane Florence moves closer to the East Coast. Dare County officials announced that a mandatory evac order is going into effect on Hatteras at this hour.
Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings says an off-duty police officer charged in the shooting death of a neighbor had parked on the wrong floor of their apartment complex's parking garage. Rawlings made the comment yesterday, the day that Officer Amber Geiger was arrested on a manslaughter charge in the Thursday killing of Botham Jean. Police have said that Geiger told officers who responded to the shooting that she had mistaken Jean's apartment for her own. Journalist Bob Woodward says Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and White House Chief of Staff John Kelly are not telling the truth when they deny making disparaging statements about President Trump attributed to them in his new book, Fear. Kelly is quoted calling Trump an idiot, and Mattis says Trump has the understanding of a fifth or sixth grader. Woodward said this morning on NBC's Today Show the men's denials are political statements to protect their jobs. Shares of CBS are falling in the first day of trading after the ouster of Les Moonves, the company's chairman. Moonves stepped down late Sunday following a story posted by The New Yorker that included a second round of sexual misconduct accusations against the powerful television executive. On the broader market, the Dow was down about 20 points in midday trading. Partly sunny to mostly sunny skies for Minnesota today. Highs in the 70s. Some showers and thunderstorms could pop up in the north. Time now, 11:37.
Programming supported by the Walker Arts Center, now featuring Sia Armajani, Follow This Line, an exhibition featuring works by the Iranian-born, Minneapolis-based artist from the past 60 years. On view through December 30th. More at walkerart.org.
On the next NPR News Presents, a new education documentary from APM reports, Changing Class, Are Colleges Helping Americans Move Up? Listen as the team explores the social significance of college Monday at noon and 9 p.m.
It's not a chat with a political junkie unless there's some reference to Richard Nixon. If you missed my conversation with Ken Rudin this morning at 9, you can find it on the podcast every week. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you listen and listen to what Ken Rudin and I talked about today.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by the law firm of Dorsey & Whitney, worldwide and business-wise lawyers dedicated to delivering a competitive advantage to clients around the world. More information online at dorsey.com.
Back to our conversation now on free medical school tuition and to the phones to Femi in Minneapolis. Hi, did I pronounce your name right? Hi, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hi, go right ahead. I thought I might not have pronounced your name right, but glad you called in.
Not a problem. Hello.
Hi.
My name is Femi. I'm actually a former student of Dr. Powell's, and I'll say that her pathology lab class is one of my favorite classes in medical school.
Oh, excellent. She's happy to hear that.
Yeah. I'm calling because this conversation, it resonates with me very strongly. When I graduate from medical school, I'll have $500,000 worth of student loan debt.
Oh, my.
And one of the things I want to speak about that has been touched on is how, you know, the medical field is, in many ways, is closed off to large segments of the population that, you know, as you suggested, isn't able to stomach that idea or doesn't have people who they've seen go before them do this same work and incur those large amounts of debt. And there are a lot of little things in, like small areas in parts of the process, like in the application process, which costs a ton of money for high school seniors or people going into medical school, or you know, once in medical school, like all of the fees on top of fees that we pay for a board preparation and exams and things of that nature. But additionally, I think about the interconnectedness of all of us and how, like medical bankruptcy, medical bankruptcy is the number one cause of bankruptcy in America, and how, you know, it may not seem like medical school tuition is something that someone like, I don't know, a school teacher who's not in medicine has to pay attention to, but we all, the idea that anybody could have a medical event that caused them to go bankrupt, and then the system, because it costs so much money to just medical healthcare costs so much money that one of the things that go into the cost of the system is obviously what doctors have to make what doctors make, and that adds to the overall cost of what people pay.
Can I ask you if you've decided on what kind of medicine you're going to practice?
Yeah, so at my heart, I love primary care, and I want to be a family medicine doctor. But I do go back and forth sometimes about that because, as others have suggested, it's not no one stars as a doctor. But there are other fields of medicine that allow for individuals to make more money and pay off their debt sooner. So I wouldn't be opposed to doctors making less money long term if what we paid in school fees were significantly reduced as well.
Deborah, what do you hear in your former students, you know, trying to figure this out there?
Yeah. Hi, Femi. Nice to hear from you. I think that he's right in a sense, you know, would physicians, I personally feel that the country can't sustain the healthcare costs and physician salaries may be decreasing over time. And if they are, it would be nice if they decreased with less debt to have to pay off. And so it would be interesting to see whether if the whole system was readjusted, if physicians would be more accepting of somewhat lower salaries with less debt hanging over their heads. I think that would be tough to sell to people, and I'm not sure it's the only answer, but it might be enforced on people down the road if healthcare costs keep accelerating.
Do you see that coming, Elizabeth?
Well, yes, I do think one way or another physician salaries are probably going to decrease. But I really love what the caller said about the interconnectedness of this all, because that's what I focused on in my book, was how our healthcare system has been driven by the finance rather than what's good for healthcare. And I think he's absolutely right. You know, basically, when medical students are under such financial pressure and you hear during residency about these 6% loan payments, why aren't there no interest loans for this if this is what we want people to do?
Right.
And then they get out and two things happen. They tend to go to more lucrative specialties, whether that's because they have to or because they're freaked out by the very, very big size of these numbers. And also they feel entitled, you know, to charge a lot of money, a lot of them, because, hey, I went through this whole thing and I paid out this and it was so stressful. So the whole thing becomes about how much I paid, how much I make, rather than public service and healthcare and caring and developing relationships with your patients, which I think is what most doctors in training and when they get out really want to be focusing on. But the whole focus has shifted towards, oh, my gosh, the money. And so I think there is a trickle-down effect on our bills that's very real. So we should all be caring about this issue.
Kathy says on Twitter, future medical school students should consider joining the military as a way of paying for medical school. My son joined the Navy prior to med school in 2002. It's been a terrific experience for him, although that comes with a commitment to stay in the service for a certain amount of time, I think. Jasmine says, I decided to go to medical school to give back to my community. I specifically chose to go to the U of M because of their, is it MetroPAP program, Dr. Powell? Okay.
Yes.
She says, which offers a $20,000 grant towards tuition as someone going into primary care. This is crucial, she adds. Hi, Dr. Powell. So what is the program there?
Yeah, MetroPAP is a wonderful program, and as is RPAP. RPAP has been around for 45 years. MetroPAP has not been that long, but hi, Jasmine. MetroPAP is a program where students spend 9 months of their third year in an inner city practice. It happens to be out of the Broadway Clinic here, and they are students who want to practice in inner city communities with underserved populations, and they want to be involved in primary care for those populations. So they get this real immersion in this during 9 months of their third year. And RPAP, in contrast, is 9 months in a rural small town community in Minnesota. And so Minnesota has been sort of a leader in these two areas, and it gives our students a preview of what their life would be like as a physician in these communities. And we have more data from RPAP, but they stay. They go into these communities, and they stay there, and they work there. And so we have to expose them early, I think.
Elizabeth, would you say, hey, more medical schools may not be able to raise a $450 million endowment like NYU had to do, and I think they're raising more, but more medical schools could be doing what we've just heard described?
Yeah, there are a bunch at different medical schools in different states. The military certainly has a program that allows students to pursue their interest with a loan free with a payback period. So sure, I think we could. All of these things are good. What I hear though from this student, which is interesting to me, is a $20,000 payback. What we see over time is all these programs, the payback can't keep up with the rise in medical school tuition, right? Some of the state programs will subsidize to the tune of $10,000 a year. Well, when medical school tuition is $60,000,
yeah,
that's still pretty, it's not
right.
It's not enough. So I think these programs are great. They should be encouraged. But again, NYU is spending $600 million. Other medical schools may not be able to raise that much. But if you can raise $50 million, then okay, let's focus that on these areas where we need students rather than this kind of blanket approach.
Jack in Minneapolis called to say, I'm a medical school student. It's my second year at the U of Minnesota. Once you have this debt, it's a big deterrent for students because it's a huge risk. When you're taking on that debt, there's no guarantee of job placement. So it's fair that you're highly compensated if you do get a job. And Pat in Sioux Falls called to say, I'm retired from family practice 2 years ago. They keep talking about how much money one is going to make, and family practice physicians are guaranteed about $75,000 a year, and the most I ever made 1 year was $110,000. So if I don't know if Pat graduated with medical school debt, but that's a ratio that would be kind of scary. It'll keep me up at nights, Deborah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yep. I can see why people are discouraged from going into family practice, and yet that's where the greatest need is, right?
Yeah, I think the greatest need is in primary care as well as some of the other underpaid specialties like psychiatry. And the reimbursement is very low, and it is hard. And when we talk about debt, we are really talking about, we're not even thinking about what one of the other callers said about the escalation of the interest payments. So the debt
right.
that we graduate with is not the debt they have to pay off over time. So it is a real problem. But I agree with Elizabeth Rosenthal that there are other ways to deal with this than free tuition. We could look at scholarships at the school level or at the state level for the kinds of services the state or the region needs. And selective full tuition scholarships at least take away some of the burden.
So the state of Minnesota would come in and say, we know we need doctors in X. We're going to allocate some money to the medical school
right.
to do this?
Right.
Okay.
Yes. And you can raise money from the private sector for scholarships as well,
mm-hmm.
because many people understand the need
yeah.
and are willing to either endow a scholarship or give the money for a scholarship one time that will take a student through 4 years of medical school.
Didn't a big chunk of the NYU money come from the CEO of Home Depot? Elizabeth, do I have that right?
Yeah, it came from Ken Langone. The medical school there is actually named the NYU mm-hmm. Langone medical school, I believe. So yes, it came from one donor. There are people out there who understand the need, who are willing to give. I don't know how much input Mr. Langone had into how this money was used. And I think, the cynical thing we're hearing on the web and among some of the experts is, why did NYU do this? Was it to enable people who want to go into primary care, which of course is incredibly valuable, or as we heard from one other caller, was it to somehow increase their rankings by getting every wannabe medical student in the country to apply there, even ones who might have gone otherwise to a higher ranked medical school? And I don't know the answer to that. There's a lot of cynicism out there. But I'm looking to see if both NYU and other medical schools will start with this good step and then tailor it to something that's maybe more what we need as a policy solution, because that's always what I'm thinking about.
I want to ask you both about whether you think medical school is too long, because as I mentioned, I read this this piece in The Washington Post by an ophthalmology resident who says med school should be shorter. And here's what he says. Decreasing the length of training would immediately add thousands of physicians to the workforce. At the same time, it would save money that could be reinvested in creating more positions in med schools and residencies, and I'll just add, and potentially more scholarship money. Elizabeth Rosenthal, what do you think?
That's hard. I don't know that there's an ideal length. Personally, I found the fourth year of medical school incredibly valuable in trying to decide what I wanted to do, what my mission was in life. And I think, yeah, maybe if you always knew you wanted to be an ophthalmologist, maybe that fourth year should be a flexible year. But I still think you mature as a physician. It's really hard going from residency to independent practice. And it's scary. And I found that fourth year really valuable in terms of gaining confidence, because on day one of that next year, I was in an emergency room in charge of patients who were overdosing, had wow. got knife wounds. So, yeah, I appreciated that training. So,
what do you think, Deborah? I mean, you're at the medical school. Is the fourth year or the third year, I don't know, somehow, could they be condensed?
This is something I've been working on for the last 10 years of my life. And I've been working on programs around time variable competency-based advancement.
What does all that mean?
Well, I don't think you can say that medical school should be 4 years or 3 years. The 4 years came in 1910 with the Flexner Report. But I don't think 3 years is the answer either. I think that we need to change medical school to advance students based on a specific assessment system based on measures of competence that we think they need to have before they can move into residency.
Ah.
And then each student could move at their individual pace and not necessarily all graduate at once or at the same time, because we have students who are ready to go into residency after 3 or 3.5 years and others who might take longer. This is very hard to do. We've been working on a 4-school pilot project in pediatrics for at least the last 8 years with 4 medical schools. So it's not the solution right now, but I think it might be the solution in the future. And in that project, we have students who are moving into residencies much earlier than 4 years of medical school.
So is the reason that this is taking as long as it is and you're moving so carefully because there's just a cultural belief that it's 4 years and that's what it takes? I mean, where's the barrier to making the change?
The barriers is that medicine right now, medical education is a time-based system. Medical school is traditionally 4 years. Few medical schools do it in 3 years, not many. But it's 4 years. And then residencies, you heard about the caller say,
yeah.
Orthopedic surgery is 5 years. Pathology happens to be 4 years. Internal medicine is 3 years. There is no rationale for this. It's money-based. And so it's really tradition and money that sets these time barriers. But to deconstruct that system, which has been in place for a very long time, is extremely difficult. And it's got all sorts of barriers. So our program, which is called EPAC, has shown that we can do it. One of the pilot sites is at the University of Minnesota. But it's not just as simple as being able to do it. It's being able to spread it to other parts of the system. Nevertheless, I think that there are different answers than just these time-bound programs, but it's going to take a long time to get there.
So, Elizabeth, when you hear Dr. Powell describe the tradition and the money-based, I mean, is this something that more schools could experiment with, do you think? Or is this destined to only be done in a certain number of, you know, schools that are willing to try it out?
No, I think it's a fascinating idea, because I think some people would say they didn't really get anything out of the fourth year, particularly what people who knew in advance what they wanted to go into, and it was a specialty that's relatively focused, like ophthalmology or orthopedics. I would argue that, or maybe pediatrics, where you really just wanted to focus on kids. But I would argue that for some specialties, particularly like internal medicine, where you're dealing with a whole range of problems, you might need that fourth year to get a little bit of exposure to different parts of the body, different parts of medicine, which is what the fourth year of medical school is all about.
Call here from Shukri in Apple Valley. Hi, thank you so much for waiting. I know it's been a while. Tell me what you're thinking about.
Yes, hi, Carrie. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I think, I mean, I've been reading on this one that was first published. I have mixed emotions about the free tuition at NYU. First, I want to tell you that I am a former military. I just got out in 2017. I come from a Black Hawk aviation unit.
Ah.
And so I can tell you about, you know, that policy and the oversight, and it's not just free for all, you know. So, and I also have three kids who are all under five who have this, they're called medically complex kids. And we see a great deal of, you know, physicians, and sometimes we might run out of certain specialty that maybe there's one location here at Children's and the next one is Mayo. So we go between Mayo and, you know, Children's, and I particularly moved from the state of Virginia to Minnesota for that reason. But what I want to say is that, you know, giving something for free, you know, it's great. But at the same time, in medical fields and certain fields, you know, in professional and education, I believe that, you know, a person really has to earn it. Yeah. And they don't value, you know, something given for free as much, you know, with someone who's a medical student, you know, noticing and being cognizant of the amount of debt that they're going to incur. I don't think that's the only thing that stops them. They still go through the programs. They still finish their residentships. They still go through it. And there's a lot of limitations for those, you know, medical students that they still have to think about. Like, do I start a family right now? Is it the right time? Is
right.
it an extra load? So I don't think that medical school should be free.
Okay.
I do appreciate that, you know, the physicians and their dedication to provide, you know, much needed care and even, you know, employ much needed fields. Like I said, I'm very familiar with the medical community.
Shukri, forgive me. We're about a minute out from having to wrap up the show. I think I've got the essence of what you're going to say. And one of the things is, if this is free tuition and this idea of earning it, Deborah, is there something to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very real thing. People should have a little skin in the game.
Yeah.
And I think that that is one of the challenges with free tuition. No. Do you really value it unless you put something into it?
Really good to have you here. Deborah Powell, thank you. From the University of Minnesota, where she's a physician and dean emerita, and Elizabeth Rosenthal from Kaiser Health News, also a doctor. Elizabeth, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You can keep the comments coming at on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. If you missed the show, it'll be up on the podcast within a couple hours, and you can listen back.